it's all sort of trying to demonstrate to President Maduro that it's either you leave the regime now and perhaps dictate some terms that are somewhat agreeable, or there will be a full-scale military operation to unseat you.
The U.S. has a long history of intervention in Latin America and the Caribbean, from Panama to El Salvador to Cuba. Critics say the latest pressure campaign against Venezuela fits that pattern, with troops already positioned in the Caribbean and rhetoric heating up. The standoff is no longer just about Venezuela's skies. It's about whether America is prepared to risk a wider conflict in its own backyard.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Ajay Mbarnaka, founder of Black Alliance for Peace out of New York. And John Stepling, author and commentator out of Inderøy, Norway. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off in New York. And Ajay, I mean, if the Americans actually have any proof that Venezuela is involved in drug smuggling, why doesn't Washington simply follow the appropriate channels and actions that have been set up for such grievances?
Because the U.S. is operating as a rogue state, that it sets the terms, defines the definitions, and it acts based on its own interests. If there was if there's any concern on the part of the U.S. administration to confirm their allegations of, for example, these boats being involved in smuggling drugs into the U.S. Then the other day, when they engage in another attack on one of those boats, and there appeared to be survivors, why is it that the Secretary of War apparently ordered a secondary attack to, in essence, eliminate those survivors and to basically eliminate any possibility of providing some confirmation to these allegations that these boats are involved in drug trafficking? So this is how a state that is operating beyond the law will conduct itself, and it will continue to do that until there's significant pressure and opposition coming from the international community. Unfortunately, we don't see much of that pressure emerging.
Yeah, unfortunately. Well, John, I mean, we've seen that Trump has increased the threats against Venezuela, but isn't the reality that the U.S. aggression against Venezuela, it's not a decision simply made by Trump and the Republicans, because we've seen this before from Democratic-run White House also. So what is the real problem that the United States, what's the problem they have with Venezuela?
Well, I think that they have multiple problems with Venezuela. It's a socialist government. It's part of the Bolivarian Revolution started by Hugo Chavez. They tried to kill Chavez several times and foment coups against him. Now they want to do it against Maduro. Trump openly said he was, in his first term, wanted to have regime change, so-called regime change in Venezuela, but wasn't able to elicit support. But you know, this time around, we have these open extralegal executions, essentially murder of fishermen on boats. And now a retired group of JAG lawyers, judge, advocate, general lawyers, military lawyers, have issued a statement condemning these attacks by the U.S. against the boats, claiming they are illegal orders, they are murder, that Hegseth is a war criminal, and that soldiers should actually disobey such orders. You know, and Hegseth, as your other guest alluded to the other day, made a clear order directive on that last, because there were survivors in the last attack against boats. He made clear that he wanted no survivors. He wanted helpless civilians clinging to the side of the boat or what was left of the boat. He wanted them executed. This is murder. And there are legal experts everywhere who are just appalled at this. And of course, senior military figures, especially in the Navy, have taken early retirement or simply quit because they object to how Hegseth runs things. But there's bigger questions here. The U.S., yes, hates Venezuela because it's socialist. They want the oil, yes, because they have the largest oil reserves in the world. All of that is yes. But this is a kind of distraction from other things that Trump is struggling with. His approval rating is incredibly low. The Epstein files story will not go away. People are angry about his, in quotation marks, peace plan for Ukraine. So this was seen as a popular project.
Okay.
Marco Rubio is the driving force, though, the little kind of Gusano fascist who is now Secretary of State. This is his pet project.
Well, what about that, Anjuma? Do you agree with what John has said, that this is a sort of a distraction from other decisions, less popular decisions, but the decision dealing with Venezuela is also not a popular decision, as has been alluded to. The schism that we are seeing from former military individuals and with the current Pentagon. I mean, your thoughts on exactly what is happening here, and are we seeing this type of a schism possibly increasing, or how do you see it?
Well, I think it is a bit of a distraction, but let's remind ourselves that there's a particular logic to what is unfolding with Venezuela. Venezuela is consistent with U.S. policy in terms of its commitment to regional dominance. This is part of their national security strategy. It's based on the notion of full spectrum and dominance. And Venezuela is key. Is key to the entire Americas region, both the states in so-called Latin America, but also the Caribbean. So the move being made by the U.S. is consistent with those principles and those strategic objectives. What we're seeing in addition, though, is what made the U.S. and the West what it is today. This is straight up thievery. They want the oil in Venezuela and in Guyana. They want to be able to control the fact that in Latin America you have 31% of all of the planet's fresh water. They want to be able to influence the lithium and the lithium triangle. They want the copper in this part of the world. So this is part of the imperialist project. It's part of the colonial project that resulted with the Western nations becoming the predominant powers on this planet. So there's a logic to this. It's a cynical and backward logic, but is nevertheless a logic. Mm-hmm. And that logic is the continuation of the colonial imperialist domination by the U.S. And their Western allies.
Mm. Well, John, I mean, what does it mean when Trump says Venezuelan airspace is closed? And what does it mean for Venezuela, and what does it mean for the United States?
Well, this is an interesting question. the colonial aspect is absolutely true. I mean, this is the very definition of U.S. imperialism. And they, the U.S., and the ideologues in the White House and all those think tanks in D.C., they view that oil in Venezuela and, yeah, the rare earth minerals, copper, and whatever else they're going to discover. It's an extraordinarily rich country in terms of natural resources. They view that as theirs, and they resent the fact that they don't control it. It's why they hated Chavez so much. So the question, though, with the declaration of airspace being closed, what it means, well, I think the bigger question is what does Trump and Hegseth think this invasion is going to look like? The U.S. can't occupy Venezuela. They can bomb it. I don't think they can send troops on the ground, boots on the ground, into Venezuela, into the extraordinarily deep jungles of that country and mountains, if they don't have the resources. They couldn't beat Yemen. And so this is, an extraordinary sort of spectacle of saber-rattling and bellicose rhetoric, but I'm not sure what they're going to do. Trump has been threatening this invasion for several months now and claiming, he's a narco-terrorist, Maduro, so forth. And it should be noted that the cartel he's accused of running doesn't even exist. There are no drugs coming into the United States on those boats. The boats don't have the range to get to the United States. And there's never been any evidence that Maduro has anything to do with drugs.
And so
all of this is just a fantasy because the U.S. wants, a distraction, B, it's something they've longed to do for 40 years. But I don't know how they're going to do it, you see.
Okay, stay with me, John. Stay with me. Let me get Ajuma back in this discussion. I mean, Ajuma, at the same time that Trump is creating this scenario about Maduro and trafficking drugs to the states, he also, at the same time, is pardoning former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was a U.S. puppet and smuggled hundreds of tons of cocaine into the U.S. So let's talk about this and the paradox, doing this at the same time. I mean, if smuggling drugs, well, he's using that as the reason for all of this. So what kind of sense does it make to pardon Hernandez at this point in time?
Well, what it demonstrates is the consistency of the thinking of the individuals in that administration. That basically, again, has nothing to do with drugs. The fact of the matter is that this former Honduran president is responsible for something like 400 tons of cocaine being smuggled into the United States, but yet he is going to receive a pardon. So again, the only way one understands the U.S. policy vis-a-vis Venezuela is to put it in global context. One has to understand that this Venezuela policy is an extension of the U.S. policy in West Asia, the attacks using Fort Israel into southern Lebanon, the undermining of the government in Syria, the attacks on Iran, that this is part of their global strategy to maintain and to expand U.S. and Western dominance. So that's the only way that one can really understand this. If we get into the minutia of all the various details, and we can kind of distract ourselves. This is part of an imperialist project, and we need to understand that. And we need to understand that this government, this state, is prepared to continue to operate beyond the bounds of international law and international morality. And all states need to understand that. And the peoples on this planet need to understand that. That basically, this is a declaration of war that the Trump administration has declared on the rest of the planet and the rest of the people. Mm-hmm. Therefore, they represent now an existential threat to global humanity. That's
right.
The reality we
have
to deal with.
Well, interesting point. What about that, John? It represents an existential threat because if this could happen to Venezuela, that Trump can do this, what stops it from happening to any country, friend or foe? Because we have seen how Trump even deals with the friends. I mean, shouldn't all countries be standing up against this?
Well, of course. I mean, of course, because this is just pure colonialism at work. It's imperialism at work. They want to go in and steal the resources. There are lots of different motivations behind this particular project, but it's also a sort of search for a cause, a search for a meaning. Trump wants to have some wins on his ledger, and he doesn't have any. The U.S. is domestically in crisis. The military is not the force that it was 30, 40 years ago that scares anybody. They've had one defeat after another. And as I say, they can't really invade Venezuela. It will be a catastrophe. So this is a lot of verbiage and a lot of show. And you note that the only thing that's actually happened is blowing up these little harmless fishing boats or whatever they were. Maybe they were smuggling cigarettes. Who knows? They certainly aren't narco-terrorists. Right. So, that's all that's actually been, you know, the U.S. has been able to do is blow up a few boats and kill 60 or 70 civilians. I don't know if they try something larger what the result will be. But, yes, are they an existential threat? Of course. The U.S., okay. Imperialist power, and they need to be stopped.
All right. Well, Anjuma, I mean, John talks about, you know, these like a little victory or whatever for the U.S. in the middle of so much failure. But let's look at the reality. I mean, Venezuela has a population of like 28.5 million people compared to the U.S. 341 million, and the U.S. is 10 times the size of Venezuela. I mean, what type of victory is that? I mean, what type of so-called superpower would actually feel that this is any type of victory in doing what it is doing in the way that it is?
I guess they are calculating that if you control and contain Venezuela, you can control and contain the Americas regions. So that is the strategic objective. But I think you're absolutely right, and John is right also, that basically this military operation is fraught with real concerns for the U.S. They have suffered defeat after defeat when they have intervened militarily. But what's going to happen, I think, because they have accumulated this armada off the coast of Venezuela, I think the Trump administration is compelled to do something, as ill-advised as it may be. And the result will be that there will be Venezuelan people, if that happens, who will unnecessarily lose their lives.
Well, John, your thoughts about that? I mean, with the situation, do you see Trump actually going for it? Because you said a couple of times that you don't see the U.S. putting boots on the ground. And we have the Venezuelan people who say that they will do whatever it takes to defend their land. So where do you see this going? Do you see an actual invasion taking place? Or how do you see the U.S. handling this situation?
Yeah, I mean, this is the question. I think, honestly, that Trump would love an off-ramp at this point. And he may pivot in some way to a diplomatic solution, because I think there are a few veteran military minds still around at the Pentagon who are advising him this is a very bad idea. And Hegseth is not one of them, and Rubio is not one of them. But I think, were he going to actually invade Venezuela with boots on the ground and launch an amphibious assault, he would have done it already. All this sort of, you know, pot shots at these boats that pose no threat to anybody, they're unarmed boats. This is just optics. This is just, you know, a photo op for Pete Hegseth. There's nothing substantive. You have to remember what happened with Yemen. Trump eventually, you know, signed a deal with Yemen, an agreement, because they couldn't put a dent in the Houthis shutting down of the Red Sea. And this is the poorest country in the Arab world. So I don't think Venezuelans are actually scared. They're very tired from the sanctions, from the constant, you know, political and trade pressures put on them. I'm sure they would love some kind of relief from that. And Maduro has behaved in an exemplary way, actually. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I don't know what Trump thinks the end game is here, but my guess would be that he will back away from an invasion.
Okay, well, speaking of backing away from invasion, I mean, Anjuma, we know that Trump said he's willing, and he allegedly had a phone call with Maduro, and now is saying he's willing to meet with Maduro. Do you agree with John that possibly he's looking for, as he called it, a deal with Venezuela now, or no? Do you see that the aggression will continue? 1 minute, please.
The aggression will continue. Any conversation between Maduro and Trump would be one in which Trump will try to put pressure on him to basically surrender. The military action that could take place and might take place will be primarily bombings. They'll bomb Caracas to the ground if they can. So, no, I don't have much faith in any kind of negotiated settlement at this time.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me. Anjuman Baraka, founder of Black Alliance for Peace out of New York. John Stepling, author and commentator out of Inderoy. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The rise and fall of civilizations has been endless. It's a natural process, the circle of life. No matter how majestic or insignificant some of these civilizations might have been, the ruins, the traces of their time on this earth are an invaluable part of our history.
The one important thing is what we can decipher from these ruins and the insight they might depart us. Iran is a land rich with ancient history. The burnt city, or Shahr Sukhte in Farsi, is a unique heritage and narrates the story of the Sistan and Balochistan region. The excavated findings from this site can fill some of the lost pages of the history of this land and its people.
This Bronze Age archaeological treasure trove is only about 6% of what it really was more than 5,000 years ago. It was once one of the world's largest communities at the dawn of civilization. Spanning 151 hectares of land, Shahr Sukhte sits along the Zahedan-Zabul road. Findings show that the burnt city first appeared around 3200 BC and was abandoned over a millennium later around 1800 BC, experiencing four stages of urbanization. Some say that it was abandoned because of climate change and drought, but the actual reasons for its rise and unexpected fall are still a mystery. Built of mud bricks, the city appears to have had a large palace, separate neighborhoods for lodgings, industrial activities, and separate areas for the production of local goods. The grounds of this vast city is littered with broken pottery, hence one can conclude that pottery was produced here on a massive scale. Şahrisuhte was first discovered in 1967 and has been continually excavated ever since the 70s. And yet, many sections are still left untouched. Only an estimated 4% has been excavated so far. The fascination of digging for buried treasure, exciting as it may be, is sweaty, tedious, and back-breaking work. Once the site's been chosen, archaeology students and workers, supervised by licensed archaeologists, carefully remove the ground cover feeling for artifacts under the soil. They wash the findings and record the details of where they had been found. This is a long process and requires a great deal of delicacy and patience. To give you a hint, it may take roughly 10 years to completely excavate this small mound. In addition to the pottery ovens and the rubbish pits, many firsts were discovered during the excavations. The first animation drawn on a goblet. Once you spin the cup, you'll be able to see a goat jumping and grazing. The first board game, a ruler with half a millimeter accuracy, and many other astonishing tools. They were true masters of their time in urbanization, architecture, mathematics, science, medicine, and engineering.
An advanced city run by women. The Burnt City is one of the rarest ancient cities in which women were responsible for handling the financial affairs of the family.
In December 2006, archaeologists came across something stunning. They found an artificial eye, would you believe? It belonged to a woman aged 32 to 36 and was estimated to have been about 4,800 years old.
One of the most astonishing finds of the city are traces of brain surgery on the skull of a 12 or maybe 13-year-old girl whose remains are over 4,000 years old.
To the west of the city is a huge cemetery that's about 25 hectares. The cemetery contains over 20,000 ancient graves, pointing to just how large the Burnt City's population had been. More than 10 different types of graves were found at this location, four types of which were more common. Simple graves, graves with two sections, crypts and burial chambers. The latter is considered to be the most important one of all. Scientists believe that the variety of burial methods points to the coexistence of different cultures within one society in the Burnt City. Reconstructions of the excavated graves and some of the artifacts found in them at the Museum of the Burnt City, which is within a walking distance, just on the other side of the road.
Some of the remains found in the excavated tombs are in the fetal position. Now, one hypothesis is that perhaps our ancient Sistani ancestors believed the position in which we were born was the proper way for us to leave the earth. Another characteristic feature of the tombs is the way husbands and wives were buried together, facing each other.
There is still so much more, from different fabrics to makeup items, jewelries, and even raisins. However, neither what remains of the buildings nor their symbolisms has helped us understand how such an advanced city could have existed 5,000 years ago. What happened to them, and why did we lose all the knowledge that they had? In a corner of Iran, hidden beneath the veil of these plains, a mysterious civilization has left its trail. maybe to show us just how remote and valuable Sistan and Baluchestan is. In every corner of this province, there is a path that leads us to a wondrous history. This is Gulnar Farnoodi for Iran.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio. It's very nice to have you with us. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. By the way, you're listening to Iran Radio. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5 of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. We'll start this hour's program with a viewpoint. The program offers an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of Islamic world today. And we round up this hour's program with A to Z of Life. The program presents an Islamic Iranian lifestyle in a variety of ways, making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, as well as inspirational poetry and stories.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Lifestyle is not just about how we live, but why we live that way, the choices that quietly shape our values and relationships and the direction of our soul. Welcome, dear brothers and sisters, to your program Viewpoint from IRIB English Radio. This is the humble host of the show. The program, Sayyid Ali, is here, and I am joined by two dear brothers, Sheikh Hussein. Assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Good to have you here. And Sheikh Liaghat Hakim, assalamu alaikum, dear brother.
Thank you so much. Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you both for being here. So, dear brother Sheikh Hussein, in a world of constant change, ignorance is vulnerability. Why does the leader of revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, describe knowledge as a source of honor, power, and security?
Well, actually, I strongly believe that he is inspired in this by the Islamic teachings. Actually, there's this hadith that the Prophet said that the person who is al-alam bi-zamana, a person who knows that his time, okay, it might be about the changes of the time or anything, la tahjum alayhi al-lawabis. So the problems, ambiguities will not invade him, something like this, okay? So if you are not aware, if you're ignorant, if you're not aware of what's going on around you, then you will be surrounded by things that are unfamiliar and exotic to you, and you will be consumed by them. So that is one Islamic teaching. Another Islamic teaching is that al-ilmu sultan, the knowledge is the source of power. And if you have knowledge, you will have power. Otherwise, you will be subjugated by others. So I think, strategically speaking, there are different layers of meaning for this saying and this perspective of knowledge that the leader reflects in his saying. So strategically speaking, for Muslim communities, for Muslim nations, this has been a source of problem since the fall of Muslim golden ages, Islamic golden ages, that we have lost our historical self-awareness, consciousness, and unfortunately, we see this kind of a struggle among Muslim nations about their own fate in human history. And at the level of individuals, if you want to take control over your life, if you want to do things beneficial for yourself and for your community, well, you have to know things. Again, there's this thing, Islamic teaching, that a person who wants to reform should have the proper knowledge for it. Otherwise, he will destroy more than the rectifying or correction that he's going to make.
Yeah.
So, at different levels, knowledge and full awareness of all different angles and all different aspects of the project that you're aiming to do is actually coming first than everything else.
So, dear Sheikh Liaghat, every culture needs role models, and we all know that. What does it mean to take the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam as models in one's personal and social life? Actually, can we do that since they live more than a thousand years ago? So how we can apply their understanding of the religion of God, their lifestyle in today's modern, you know, time?
It is definitely very important. It's definitely very important to select the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam as the role models in the present era. I would say it's more important than the previous era or the previous the historic times, past 1,000 years, I would say, which was in the major occultation. And even in today's world, it's more important than before. This is what I'm trying to say. The reason is, one of the reasons, I would say, from my perspective, this is one of the major reasons, okay? And there are other reasons too, which I, inshallah, will try to point at them. The major reason is if we try to follow the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in our individual life and our social life, there's a high possibility, the chances and the possibility that the Imam is going to reappear will increase. So when a person follows the Ahlul Bayt in his individual life, he's reforming himself. When a person is following the Ahlul Bayt, when people are following the Ahlul Bayt on a community wise to, or on a societal extent, a community based example, then their groundwork's being laid. The reformation of the society is going to happen, mm-hmm. and the acceptance of the community or the society or the place is going to happen for the 12th Imam to reappear. So this is very important, because it was because of the people, because they were not following the Ahlul Bayt, because the threat of the lives of Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam was increased, like it was increased on a daily basis. If we consider the 9th Imam, he was martyred when he was just 25. And the 11th Imam, he was martyred when he was just 28. You see? So the threat of their lives and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam example, they are created to rule the whole world, to bring justice, like the hukuma or the government of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala should be established on the world, on the whole of earth. And when their life is in threat, that is when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is going to take a step where the Imam is going to go into occultation. Mm-hmm. So when this threat to get away from the world example, there should be people who are going to support the Imam. And this can only happen when they follow the Imam. This can only happen when they follow the Ahlul Bayt on an individual basis and a social basis. So the social reform should happen. So the people should obey the Ahlul Bayt collectively. So that's the reason a lot of emphasis has been given for collective tasks. Example, if you recite a namaz on an individual, like Furada, just all by yourself, yeah, the reward is less. But when you go to the gathering as a collective prayer, if you go into Jama'ah and if you pray, example, then the reward increases like times 40, yeah, or maybe more than that. Exactly. Yeah. So a lot of emphasis has been placed on collective gatherings. Example, Salatul Jummah, example, you see. So why? Because the teachings are revived. The society as on the whole are going to follow the Ahlul Bayt, the role models, who are the real role models for the society. And the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam are not just created for the individual basis purpose. Like the Prophet has come in order to establish the government. Like, yeah, he had a government. And likewise, when the Imam is going to reappear, he will have a government. So, yeah. So, inshallah, that we follow the Ahlul Bayt on both the levels, on the level of individuality and as well as the social reform, inshallah.
Amen. Thank you. Consumerism dominates modern economies. And I don't know whether Sheikh Hossein, you have heard that the more there's this whole philosophy behind it, the more you buy, the better off those company be, right? And we see that a lot of people, millions, unfortunately, millions of Muslims are still using and buying the, for instance, Israeli products as well. How can we reform our consumption patterns to align with Islamic principles of moderation in that regard?
Okay, it's a very good question, a deep one, and I hope I can just contain it in one answer. You know, the different elements of the Western lifestyle are interconnected. So when you have consumerism, there are different other elements that are connected to it. Like, for example, the celebrity culture.
Yeah.
It tells you that you have to buy this because if you want to look classy, if you want to look modern, if you want to look up to date, you have to have like this kind of cell phone. Otherwise, you're canceled. You are not a good citizen of this global world. Mm. Huh? So this creates this dream in your mind. You spend hours working just to earn enough money to buy this in order to be looking like that person.
Or keep up with the
pace of the technology or living on the edge. So there are different elements. The whole thing is interconnected. And this is the big difference between Islamic civilization and current Western civilization. What's the difference? The difference is in Western civilization, they say instead of greed is something bad in people, okay? Instead of like curing greed or in our education, let's take care of it and tell people and educate people to get rid of greed and do not enter a constant race of buying and showing off. And instead of that, they say, no, let's acknowledge greed and let's profit based on the greed.
How?
Like for example, people have the greed, and then we can use that in order to maximize our profit. So not only we don't try to rectify this, we don't try to solve it, we don't try to give people proper education to control their greed, we actually celebrate it. We actually tell people, okay, it's good that you have greed. Come and buy from us. And this is actually better for us. So you use people's greed. You use people, like, for example, people have a desire for sex and the lust, okay? Sexual desire. Instead of channeling that to create families, sustainable families, you say, okay, let's profit from this to make profit from the sexual desire of people. You create platforms for porn industry. You know the turnover of porn industry annual, like some billion dollars. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of this?
One of the like.
So most everything profitable. Is defined by the value of the money that people make and things like this. In Islam, no, it's not like that. If you see greed in people, you have to buy education. You have to tell people, you know what? This is not correct. You cannot make profit out of the problems that are there in people. Mm-hmm. You cannot just say, okay, I don't care about how people have miserable lives, so let me create this race among the girls that they do not look beautiful. You know, there's this big problem among girls that they go under certain, different cosmetic surgeries to look like the other celebrities.
It's like an everlasting competition.
Yes,
they never
it's
satisfied.
A competition, and then they fall into depression and everything, that you're not sufficient, you're not good enough. It's always constantly being told to average girls around the globe because you do not look like that iconic thing that we have created for you, and also the boys. So this is a constant spiral.
So what does Islam, sorry for interruption, what does Islam suggest as an alternative to use that sense of greed in human?
Islam says there's a level of decent aspiration for you to build a decent life, and that is good. Or the sexual desire, it's not bad, it's good. It should be channeled to the right track, to the right direction. The right direction is that for you to use that sexual desire, intimacy, in order to have a sustainable family. Or that thing that is called greed, there is a positive part to it, which is longing for better conditions in life. And that's a good thing, because it makes you build a good life, decent life. It should be channeled toward real things that would benefit you and the totality of human civilization. Not that you create market in some countries, you take the resources and then you keep selling them the products that you're making, you take the labor from other countries. You know what happens here is that cheap labor of like some eastern countries are put with the resources of other countries from the milking cows, and then the real benefit goes to the pocket of people from a third country that don't have anything to do with it. So this is enslavement in a different form.
Exactly.
Cheap labor in addition to the resources of other countries, and then we print some dollars and then we get the benefit from it. So once people become aware of this, they realize that there is something wrong with this system. This system is not the ideal system, the just system that we want from human civilization.
Okay, thank you so much for both of you for being here, and may God grant us wisdom to understand and learn deeper understanding about Islamic way of life and practice the life that he prefers for us, because indeed, it's the life that suits our physical and spiritual lives. Till another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
show that you're the one who cares the most. And to us, you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, except Allah. يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها
from east to west. Throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, advising the good. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on IRIB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And look, advising the good and sort of forbidding the bad, this is something that is really important, and, you know, it's something that I don't think we engage in. Either we're not engaging in it, we're supposed to sort of be aware of it and just use it. It's supposed to be like a daily habit. So that's one thing. It's supposed to be a normal behavior. And at the same time, if we are engaging in it, there are ways of doing it, and there are sort of times where we're not supposed to do it. So there are also conditions that are important if we want to actually be doing it. So, what do we do about this? And I'm just going to mention actually quite beautiful little anecdote from life of one of the famous martyrs of the Holy Defense, Saeed Jan Buzurgi. So he took this of advising the good to a really beautiful level. So he was, for example, really concerned to help his wife with her spiritual development. And, you know, this is something that, you know, we should be doing. So we think, traditionally, we think about helping our children with their spiritual development. But, you know, we should be doing it for our spouses as well. We should be doing it for other family members, for our friends. If there's something really beautiful that we find, you know, edifying, especially Islamic sources, but anything even that is edifying and beautiful that helps our soul, that helps us to maybe look at our inner nature and sort of polish away some of the flaws or indeed increase, strengthen the good things in us, we should share that because it helps others. So he, for example, advised his wife, so Saeed Jan Buzurgi, advised his wife to listen to a particular radio program every day by a certain ayatollah. And why? So this ayatollah was talking about akhlaq, for example, regarding marital life and mutual respect and mutual understanding, something very beautiful. Welcome back to A to Z here on RIB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And I'm talking about this idea that, you know, we're advising the good and prohibiting the bad. So at the moment, I'm just talking about advising the good. And maybe I'll just focus on that. Maybe I'll talk about the more difficult aspect, because advising the good is so easy, especially nowadays. You know, we're very, whenever we find something good, a very good Islamic source or other beautiful things that are sort of spiritual and edifying. We should talk about it with our family members, our spouses, friends, and we can easily share these beautiful things. Because maybe just sharing one lovely source with one of our friends sort of makes their day, because maybe they had a particular question in their mind that day, a particular difficulty they were dealing with. And maybe if we share something beautiful with them, it just sort of, sometimes it can actually answer that precise question they were having. So I've had that sometimes. You know, I literally asked something of Allah. Maybe there was something on my, or something in my heart, basically. And one of my friends shared something with me. I think maybe recently there was a beautiful poem by Maulana also called Rumi. And yeah, and it addressed exactly that question. You know, obviously, and we also know that this is how Allah sometimes answers things. He will send us the words, the things we need to hear via other sources. So that's advising the good. So anything good we know or we find, let's share it, let's help everyone. When it comes to obviously prohibiting the bad, now this is obviously this is trickier. And I just remind people, this is something we also need to be engaged in. But it also means that we have the knowledge that there is a bad thing to do. We need to be able to say to ourselves, okay, I know that this is not something good. And then we also need to know that if we speak to this person, there's a likelihood they will even listen to us. And then we need to be able to do it in a way that is actually useful for them. So it's not humiliating. We're not pointing something out in public where they're sort of other people are listening in. So it has various conditions. But inshallah, think about that too. And I pray that you gain some reminders from today, and look forward to welcoming you to another episode of A to Z here on Arab English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio, broadcast from Tehran. Nice to have you with us. We'll start this hour's program with our morning news bulletin. Then it's time for our radio productions feature. After that, we have Israel Watch, the program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about current events and issues in the West Asia region. Then it's time for Leaders' Speech. In this program, we air a selection of statements and speeches by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, translated into English. And we round up this hour's programs with Round the World with reporters. Reporters from all over the globe tell us what is happening in the corner of the world. Listen to fascinating reports from distant lands.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Israeli forces continue to violate the Gaza ceasefire deal, with Hamas killing more women and children in fresh strikes across the war-torn territory. Palestinian officials say Israeli forces have abducted 21,000 civilians in the occupied West Bank since the Gaza genocide started on October 20th.